Good morning. Well, now you know what it's like for me when I go into meetings with John Lizette in Michigan State Senate, and my head, after an hour I leave, my head spinning. I've never met someone who talks faster and imparts more content in such a short period of time. But it speaks to the quality of the legislative staff in Michigan, which has been just wonderful to work with. So my name is Marshall Clement. I'm the Project Director for Justice Reinvestment with the Council of State Governments. I'm just going to try to connect the dots between some of the presentations thus far and provide a little bit of background on the process that we use in these two states and other states where we've worked. So don't need to reiterate the problem, right? Spending on corrections is up in states around the country. This is New Hampshire, which Ann mentioned. Recidivism rates within just 2 years, their recidivism rate climbed from 40% to 51%. We talk about reentry programs dropping recidivism by 10% or 5%. They've got a problem situation where recidivism is increasing by over 20%, right? 11 percentage points within just a two-year period. And obviously, state spending at current levels is just simply unsustainable, let alone the projected increase that a lot of states like Indiana, North Carolina, Oregon, other states are seeing for their prison populations and the associated costs that would come along with that. So in this climate, policymakers need good data. They need a strategy, obviously. They recognize the need to have a strategy to reduce spending on corrections, to increase public safety. But they have also good reason to be skeptical, right, of just picking something off the shelf or picking up the latest trend, investing in programs, et cetera. And the evidence for this isn't better than coming from Ohio, where Dr. Ed Latessa, many of you are probably familiar with his research, looking at residential treatment programs and residential community corrections programs and the outcomes that they're getting. We're working in Ohio now. They spend $100 million a year on residential community corrections program. This is a huge, huge investment, especially for the current budget times that we're in. John talked about the $57 million they're investing in reentry programs just for parolees. This is $100 million for probationers and parolees. The good news is there's a program that Ohio is funding that reduces recidivism for that group compared to a matched sample by 50%. That's tremendous. The problem is there's also a program in another part of the state that increases their recidivism rate by 50%. And on we go until basically you look at this graph and you realize that it pretty much that $100 million is a wash. Right? All their impact on recidivism has been outstripped by those programs that are increasing recidivism by not following evidence-based practices, by focusing on low-risk offenders, et cetera. And so, in fact, Ohio, for spending $100 million, is basically where New Hampshire is, having not spent a dime and not having any impact on recidivism. So what can policymakers do to get good data to make sure that the strategies they take are going to have the appropriate impacts on both crime, public safety, and correction spending? Over the last 6-7 years, we've developed this justice reinvestment approach with support from BJA and Pew Center in the States and other private foundations and working in states across the country. It starts with an interest and commitment by state leaders from all three branches. And this is what makes it unique from most any other research or work in the states that's trying to influence policy. We start with a commitment from the governor, the Senate president, the speaker, the chief justice have to agree that they want to actually work together and pursue this data-driven approach. They have to set up a work group or a task force that will have their direct representatives. In New Hampshire's case, this is completely blew us away. Every time we would go to New Hampshire, Ann's boss, the attorney general, would share a meeting that included, literally, every meeting for 3 hours, the chief justice, the two presiding justices, the speaker of the House, the Senate president, the legal counsel, and the commissioner of corrections and other cabinet members. It was a truly remarkable group. For hours on end, they would dive into the research. In no other state have we seen that, but it's a kind of a testament to the commitment that state policymakers have to address these issues. We have kind of a three-phase process, pretty straightforward. First, to just analyze the data and develop the policy options in that iterative process that Ann mentioned. Second, to work on the implementation issues that John highlighted are so critical to actually making sure you're getting the impact you want. And then third, making sure the state has a capacity and a dashboard of indicators that are going to actually help them track whether or not these policies are having the intended impact. So as you heard from some of the presentations, we look at a comprehensive view of the criminal justice system. We're looking at crime, arrest, conviction, jail, prison, probation, parole data over a 5 to 10 year period, case level data to the extent we can get it to really analyze this issue from all angles. We engage hundreds of stakeholders in each state from all parts of the system. There's only so much the data can tell you. Often what the data tells you is actually wrong, because it's data, bad data systems, as you all are familiar with in a lot of these parts of the system. We map prison admissions and social services to look at mismatch and spatial opportunities. And then finally, we develop a set of policy options that, as John and Anne both mentioned, first are recognize the political context, right? We start with what the policymakers agreed to. So in both New Hampshire and Michigan, the first conversation we had with them was, what's off the table? Well, addressing mandatory gun laws, mandatory drug laws, and truth in sentencing, they're off the table. Find out what else we can do. And so we start with a context in which we understand what policymakers can actually be enacted and will be pragmatic. We work to identify the assistance from BJA and other entities that are going to be needed to actually translate these policies into practice. We develop a coordinated implementation plan that keeps policymakers engaged. And then we deploy the reinvestment strategies. And then finally, this tracking impact. Inevitably, some policies aren't going to be implemented correctly. Some policies aren't going to work or have unintended consequences that no one can see, and we need to make mid-course corrections. So you've heard about New Hampshire and Michigan, two states that are still early on in the process. I wanted to share just some of the state experiences from states we've worked in years past and what they've seen in terms of some of the outcomes. We've worked or are currently working in 13 states around the country that are indicated here. Starting back as early as 2004 in Connecticut, and then moving through some of these other states in the intervening years. In Kansas, where we worked in 2007 with Republican legislators and Governor Sebelius, a Democrat at the time, they were facing projected growth in their prison population of 27%. They're going to have to spend about $500 million over the next 10 years in order to absorb that growth in construction and operating costs. And so the question that the Republican majority leader was asking was, if we're going to spend $500 million to impact crime, is building the next wave of prisons going to be the best investment we can make? Let's first examine why our prison population is increasing to understand if that's the case. So we looked at their prison admissions, similar to some of the other states you've heard from, probation and parole revocations driving admissions, right? Not only driving admissions, but a huge percentage of the population, even though they spend less time, still almost 30% of the prison population. And the point of the state was, you're already spending $53 million on reentry. It's just you're spending it when people fail in the community and come back. So in response to this analysis, and obviously much more analysis that we developed for policymakers in Kansas, they did a number of things as part of Senate Bill 14, which they passed overwhelmingly in 2007. The key thing they did was take some lessons they'd learned from reducing parole revocations through risk assessment, through evidence-based practices, cognitive behavioral motivational interviewing, other training they'd done with staff, and they had to figure out how to apply that to their probation system, which was scattered, locally run community corrections programs. And so the legislature established a grant program, put $4 million into it, and said it's competitive, but the goal is to reduce probation revocations in each of these jurisdictions by 20%. Come up with a credible plan that uses evidence-based practices that focuses on the high-risk offenders to do that, and we'll award these grant funds accordingly. They did that, and since 2006, they've seen probation revocations drop 26% statewide. Some jurisdictions have dropped even by 40 or 50% within just 2 years. Parole revocation rates, which had already been on the decline, continued to decline with additional funding reinvestment from the state. By 48%, parole absconders are down 70%, and the parole reconviction rate, a key indicator to know if we're just ignoring behavior, if we're actually changing behavior, among those on supervision, down 35% from the two-year averages that we're looking at there. As a result, they've averted all the growth in the projected in their prison population. This is the 2007 projection and the 2008 projection, which assumed the bill that they passed, Senate Bill 14. And then you can see the actual population in the blue line down below. They're actually getting better results than we anticipated. In part, that's because they've done better. In part, that's also because we're incredibly conservative about the impact that these policies can have when we estimate the cost savings. As a result, they're not only avoided $500 million of prison construction that they were facing back in 2007, but they've also actually been able to close a couple of small prisons over the last couple of years as a result of these declines. In Arizona, their prison population was growing tremendously, but primarily due to resident population growth, not because of other trends. And so policymakers there, Republicans in the Senate, who were kind of taking the lead on this effort, with us really wanted to identify a crime-fighting strategy. Arizona has one of the highest crime rates in the country. And instead of looking at reentry, which is a fairly small population because of truth in sentencing, very few people on post-release supervision in Arizona, they wanted to look at probation, which is a large population and a large opportunity to reduce crime. And so they set up a performance funding incentive mechanism to drive performance from the state level at the local level in terms of county probation. So every year now, the legislative budget staff calculates the probation failures, people in each county and by county. And they ask for each county, has crime gone up? Has the rate of new convictions, new felony convictions for people on probation gone up or down? If it's gone up, there's no funding. End of story. But if it's gone down and the revocation rate went down to prison, then the legislature has said in law that they will provide the county with 40% of the averted costs at the state level. And that's calculated on a fully loaded $20,000 a year, $20,000 per revocation, because there's a number of contract beds that Arizona could close to generate those savings. And the local probation agency can reinvest that in drug and mental health services, as well as victim services. Those are the two designated areas for which they can use those funds. In just 1 year, from 2008 to 2009, we've seen probation revocations to prison fall 13% in the state. They didn't just shift these to jails, which are county-funded in Arizona. Those also dropped 14%, and they were able to hold or slightly reduce, depending on the county, the rate at which people on probation were committing new felony convictions. As a result, the state estimated savings is around $17.8 million in just 1 year after implementation. Number of issues to discuss we can go into in terms of Arizona and actually carrying out the reinvestment. Guess what? Budget crisis. Sorry, we can't do it this year. Passed the law saying we'll come back next year and pick this up again when we have new resources. So huge implementation challenges in terms of actually coming through with the reinvestment that they promised back in 2008. In Texas, we worked in 2007. They were facing this 2007 baseline projection. Their prison population was going to grow from 155,000, about the size of my hometown in Oregon, to in 2006 to over 163,000 in 2009. Just 5 years, they're going to have to build 17,000 new prison beds. And policymakers there, after building 100,000 prison beds over the last decade and a half and spending $1 billion to do so, started asking themselves, so when does this, you know, prison building thing stop, right? We just keep doing it and doing it, and it's got to stop at some point, right? What's the answer? And so our researcher, director of research in Texas, came in, did an exhaustive analysis, and found a number of areas, a number of reasons. One reason was that due to budget cuts, the legislature had to cut in-prison drug treatment. Guess what? The parole board didn't stop demanding that people participate in drug treatment, even if they were low-risk drug offenders. And so you had 2,000 people taking up, you know, several prisons in Texas because they were waiting for that program that had been defunded. That, probation revocations, parole revocations, a number of things that were causing the prison population to continue to increase. They put forward a proposal, a set of massive investments, $241 million in a two-year biennium, invested in intermediate sanctions for probation and parole revocations, expanded outpatient drug treatment, mental health treatment, the nurse family practitioner partnership program, a range of things across the state of Texas that enabled them to actually pursue over the last 3 years basically aversion of all that growth in the system. Just in 2 years alone, they saved $443 million. At the same time, they saw parole revocations down 25%, probation revocations statewide down 4%. So I know we're running out of time. We want to leave time for questions and answers. We've been throwing a lot of stuff at you. But just to highlight some key themes and challenges that maybe we can pick up in some of the question and answers. The first is that in justice reinvestment, we're analyzing trends across the entire criminal justice system. So there's some confusion, and not confusion, but disagreement within our staff about whether this is actually able to be read by policymakers or if it's just a confusing mess of a presentation. But like it or not, this is the mess that is the criminal justice system, and it's confusing. But we need to understand all the boxes and what's happening in each of these trends in order to actually see what's happening, right? Green boxes, you're getting better outcomes. Red boxes, you're getting poor outcomes. And you need to use this to diagnose kind of where the problem is in the system, what you need to be focusing on. So for New Hampshire, which is this chart is for, helped us realize that crime is low. There's some front-end pressure in the courts But guess what? It's not coming to prison. It's not what's driving your prison population. Probation, revocation, stable. It's all the back end. It's all parolees that are driving the increase in the prison population there. This is true in most of the states we're working in, not all, where we're seeing parole and probation revocations being the main driver. The second major area, and this is not a surprise to researchers, the research has been clear for a very long time about targeting resources on those that have most likely to reoffend, right? We come up with fancy names for this, risk principle and all these other things, but at the end of the day, it's just targeting resources to those who are most likely to cause the most harm. It's a pretty simple concept. And we know we have risk assessments that can, you know, group people into low, medium, and high risk, and the rearrest rate will vary with those groups. Yet, unfortunately, in a lot of the states we're working, the supervision levels based on those risk levels looks pretty much like that, right? There's a huge mismatch between what we know about risk and where the states are. The state we're working in currently, which I won't mention the name of, 100,000 people on probation and parole. They are supervising they do a risk assessment, have been doing it for 5 years. It's very clear the differences we see between the high and medium and low risk groups. Everyone is supervised with the exact same contact standards, regardless of their risk level. And guess what? They're running out of probation resources, so they're hiring a bunch more probation officers because they need to reduce caseloads. Another point is we know we need to reallocate program resources to increase the impact on recidivism, right? Thanks to a lot of the meta-analyses that have been done and supported by NIJ and Steve Vose's work and others, we know what works and what works more than other programs, but when we look at most, when we go into a state and we look at where dollars are allocated currently, they're not aligned with the research. Obviously, there are different programs and people have different preferences. The biggest is that, for instance, in New Hampshire, there's a fair amount of money being spent on programs to reduce recidivism, but it's all being spent behind bars, right? It's not being spent in the community. And for instance, we know that drug treatment provided in the community is going to be roughly twice effective as it is behind bars in prison. And so a huge reallocation is not only between programs that don't work, like boot camps, to those that do, but also from inside the facilities out into the community where we can have a bigger impact. The other issue is not just funding those programs, but making sure your funding programs are high quality. In every state we've worked in applied justice reinvestment, maybe with the exception of Michigan, there has never been a full-on evaluation of any of the programs they're currently funding, and it's just not feasible to do that, right, even though that's what we'd prefer. And so using, whether it's a CPAI or CPC tools that assess the quality of the program, very cheap, very quick, and easy to administer, we can get a sense of how high quality these programs are and be able to correlate that based on some of the research with expected impact on recidivism. So here's some of Latessa and his colleagues' research, again, looking at Ohio programs. 14% of the programs they're funding are rated poor, and when they looked at the recidivism rates for those programs, they were increasing recidivism by 15%. Good news is some programs were actually decreasing recidivism, but only about 5% of the programs were in a major way, and 26% actually saw a 12% decrease. It's not too bad. But over half the programs weren't having basically any impact at all. Researchers need this kind of real-time evaluation research in order to know what programs are working, which ones aren't. They can't wait around for long-term research findings when they're funding, especially in the case of Ohio and Michigan, lots of programs at lots of different levels. Final point, and this is more of something that we're eager to maybe talk about with many of you who are studying this kind of work, but this is research from Michigan where we looked at everyone who'd been arrested and everyone who's on probation and parole and looked at the overlap. Because we know we've got a crime problem in Michigan. We want to know to what degree is probation and parole an effective tool at reducing crime, serious crime. And so we looked at the arrests for index crimes, which we know are low. There's low clearance rates in Michigan. But we found it was only 10% of those arrested for index crimes in 2007 were on probation and parole at the time of their arrest. Now, obviously, a lot more were on probation or parole in their past or at some point in their history. But this has huge implications for how policymakers think about what probation and parole can do to reduce serious crime. There's no doubt they can do a lot. But even if we reduced recidivism to zero for everyone on probation and everyone on parole, we'd still have 90% of our index crimes, this research suggests, occurring. And so this has huge implications for how we think about and how we communicate with policymakers and how we need to reinvest not only in probation and parole systems, but also in law enforcement, crime prevention, other parts on the front end of the system. So with that, I'll stop, and I think we want to take questions from those of you who have them.